You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 26th of November 2020 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Live from London, this is The Globalist. I'm Emma Nelson, and a very warm welcome to today's programme. Coming up, Japan's Prime Minister encourages his country's citizens to travel, only to tell everyone to stay at home. We'll examine Yoshihide Suga's first significant slip-up since he took power and ask how much it'll cost him. Plus, can Boris Johnson successfully woo US President-elect Joe Biden, who once described the British Prime Minister as a Trump clone? And Switzerland's President discusses how her government has approached the pandemic.
Now we are in this situation, we have to learn where is federalism still very positive, because it helps us to take the decisions very close and very specific.
Plus, no COVID jab, no flight. Qantas makes it mandatory for passengers to prove they've been vaccinated before boarding. All that plus the newspapers, the business headlines and a tribute to Diego Maradona. That's all ahead on The Globalist, live from London. First, a quick look at what else is happening in today's news. Donald Trump has pardoned his former top security adviser, Michael Flynn, who pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI. A British-Australian academic has thanked her supporters and diplomatic efforts to secure her release from jail in Iran. And Germany has asked countries across the European Union to keep their ski resorts closed until the start of January to stop the spread of coronavirus. Stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on these stories. But first, since he entered office 2 months ago, Japan's Prime Minister has enjoyed a high popularity rating, as many new leaders do. But Yoshihide Suga now finds himself facing his first real struggle, how to retain the trust of his citizens, who not long ago were encouraged to bolster the economy through domestic travel, but who are now being told to stay at home. Well, let's hear more from Monocle's Asia editor and Tokyo Bureau Chief Fiona Wilson. She joins us from the Japanese capital. Welcome, Fiona.
Good morning.
So what has happened here then?
Well, Suga has got a real challenge here. I mean, he was the brains behind this go-to travel campaign, which was really designed to encourage people in the autumn to travel around Japan, spend money in hot springs and hotels, boost the economy. And perhaps not surprisingly, what's happened is we've seen a surge in infection rates, particularly in certain areas. So key areas like Sapporo in the north, Osaka, big city in West Japan, Tokyo, Nagoya. And he's had to temporarily, at least, put a pause on people going to Sapporo and Osaka. Are currently being, people are being told don't go there on this go-to travel campaign. And there's also a bit of a question mark whether people should be traveling to and from Tokyo as well. So slightly mixed messages. It's please go and spend money, but please don't do it everywhere.
Many would suggest that this is merely a prime minister watching what is happening in terms of the coronavirus infection rate and adjusting policy accordingly. But does this seem slightly different when it comes to the Japanese Prime Minister?
No, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, infection rates have gone up. I think the issue is that people were saying, experts were saying, look, if you encourage people to travel, this will probably happen. What the government was saying was that if you take all the measures, the correct steps, travel in itself doesn't necessarily lead to increased infection rates. Infection rates have gone up and, you know, people are making the link. So it makes it look as though he was putting the economy before the health of the people. It doesn't look good.
Tell us a little bit more about what the reputational damage will be for this, because Yoshihide Suga has enjoyed, what, 50% popularity rating since he came to power, which is entirely understandable. It always happens when you have a fresh leader.
Yeah, I mean, he's had pretty solid ratings, I think. You know, I think this was a stumbling block for Shinzo Abe, his predecessor, before. He was very criticised for the way the pandemic was handled, and people are really scrutinising what is he doing. The governor of Tokyo, Yuriko Koike, has always been very, very proactive. She was always a step ahead of Shinzo Abe, the prime minister. And even here, she was at a press conference last night that in Tokyo, from Saturday until December the 17th, bars and restaurants will have to close at 10 p.m. They're offering financial support to help people. But there's always a feeling that Tokyo is very decisive, and it does make Suga look a little bit indecisive. And I think you have to remember that he's taken over midterm. He only has until next September, when the leadership election will be held. And he has to hold an election by next autumn. So he needs to be going in a strong position. And, you know, it is a very difficult situation, obviously, economically. You know, everyone knows how precarious it is. And also, you know, Japan has still got this big question mark. Will there be an Olympics next summer? So I think Suga's got a very long list of challenges this year.
Indeed. I mean, this first stumbling block, being seen as A, stubborn, but B, hesitant at the same time, will that suddenly become a defining characteristic which critics will now spot in every decision he makes?
Well, I mean, it's difficult to say, because I think I absolutely agree that in one way you could say, look, he's reacted to what's happened on the ground. So it's difficult to know how it will translate. But, you know, Shinzo Abe had, you know, if you looked at it from, say, Europe or America, you'd say Japan has done extremely well in this pandemic. But you've got, a population here very critical. They want to know exactly what's going on. They didn't like the fact that in the middle of a long weekend, we just had a long weekend last weekend, Suga started making noises about putting a pause on this travel campaign while people were busy admiring the autumn leaves in Kyoto already. So I think it didn't look great. It'd be interesting to see how the ratings follow up. I mean, he's lucky because Japan's opposition has been very, very weak over the last few years, really not put up much opposition to the LDP, to be honest. And even in Parliament yesterday, in the Diet yesterday, he was getting a grilling of sorts. But it's difficult for the opposition really to strike a blow. And Yukio Edano, very experienced opposition politician, he seemed to be making some headway yesterday, but it's always difficult. The LDP, Suga's party, is just so much in the ascendancy that it's very difficult for the opposition to make an impact.
We are still dealing, though, with the legacy of Shinzo Abe, or rather Prime Minister Suga is. He's having to account for Shinzo Abe's reputation for covering the cost of dinner parties for his supporters. That there is this scandal that is still bubbling along. And how much is Suga having to deal with all this?
Yeah, I mean, that scandal of Abe's, you know, that he was basically paying, it's absolutely illegal for politicians to offer any kind of, financial incentive, any gift to supporters. And it seems sources are now saying that Shinzo Abe's office was subsidizing dinner parties over 5 years to the tune of about 8 million yen. And the problem for Suga is that he was the spokesperson, or as Yukio Edano said yesterday, he was the ringleader for the Abe government. He was busy defending Abe during this scandal, which was really going on. It's been talked about for a year or so. And Suga is having to explain now that these sources are saying it was true that Abe's office was subsidizing dinners. It's not proven, but it's now being claimed. Suga is having to say, you know, why exactly was he defending Abe if he knew that to be true? And what he said yesterday, which rather made me smile, was he said, well, whatever I said, I consulted with Prime Minister Abe beforehand. In other words, if he was telling an untruth, it's because he himself had been told an untruth. So slightly threw Shinzo Abe under the bus there, tried to distance himself from the scandal. But there's no doubt that with this and the go-to travel, the constant scrutiny about the pandemic response, it puts him under pressure.
Finally, let's talk about some breaking news in Japan, that there is a possibility that the country could go back into a state of emergency. You mentioned a moment ago, Fiona, the rising numbers of infections. But what is the likelihood that another lockdown will be imposed?
Well, Yasutoshi Nishimura, who's the minister in charge of coronavirus response, was speaking in a press conference last night, and he's been saying he just consulted with a government panel, and he said that basically the situation at the moment is, as he put it, critical, and what he wants to see is an improvement over the next 3 weeks. So these measures are being put in place, you know, in Tokyo, more restrictions, and what he said is if the numbers don't go down over the next 3 weeks, we are looking at a state of emergency potentially at the end of that. So what he's saying is if everyone does what they're supposed to do now, the New Year break can happen calmly. We won't have a lockdown situation. So he's really, I think, you know, flown a kite here to tell people really, you know, wear your masks as they are, follow the instructions, stay at home if you have to. And then, you know, things can go smoothly. But I think it was slightly alarming last night. They have these four tiers of where the measuring the seriousness of the virus, Tokyo is now 3 out of 4, as are Sapporo, Osaka, Nagoya. So the city, these big cities are, you know, are a really critical stage. And Koike, the governor of Tokyo, also said that the pressure on the medical system is reaching a critical point. The increase in severe cases is such that they are going to have to take more measures. So I think everyone's well aware now that it's a fairly critical moment for Japan.
Fiona Wilson in Tokyo, thank you as ever for joining us on The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
US President-elect Joe Biden's views on Brexit are well known. He's not a fan. And as for the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, well, Mr. Biden has described him as a kind of physical and emotional clone of Donald Trump. Undaunted, Mr. Johnson and his government have set about enthusiastically wooing the next occupant of the White House and his team, with policy announcements here in Britain, which they hope will have a positive impact in the US. One is an ambitious plan to tackle climate change, the other to bolster defence. Well, I'm joined now by Mark Landler, the London Bureau Chief of the New York Times and a former White House correspondent. Welcome, Mark.
Thanks for having me.
So just mention these two announcements, which took some people by surprise last week, not least in the United Kingdom.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, what was interesting was there was a great deal of anxiety, I think, in the United Kingdom about whether Boris Johnson was going to find himself at odds with this incoming administration, particularly on the trade negotiations with the European Union in the aftermath of Brexit, because of the possible negative impact of those negotiations on the situation in Northern Ireland. But I think that the Prime Minister kind of very cleverly reset the conversation by rolling out these two initiatives, which had a way of sending a message that Britain wants to work with this new president, understands what his priorities are, and is willing to come up with some proposals where the two countries can work together. So in a way, he shifted the conversation away from what could have been a somewhat tense exchange over Brexit and Northern Ireland.
Nonetheless, Joe Biden in the last couple of days has already come out very, very clearly. I think he did an interview with a question from RTE when he was in Delaware. And he says, we do not want a guarded border between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland. We worked hard to get Ireland worked out. We've just got to keep the border open. Now, this is in reference to the British government saying that it will actually break the terms of the Good Friday Agreement. Well, it won't break, it will endanger the Good Friday Agreement with new Brexit laws that it wants to introduce domestically. This is something that Joe Biden absolutely has no patience with, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there has always been a constituency in Washington that was extremely defensive of the Good Friday Agreement. Remember, it was an agreement that was presided over by a Democratic president, Bill Clinton. And so Democrats in Congress have always felt strongly about this. The difference here is that the Trump administration really didn't make much of a priority of this. Donald Trump was in favor of Brexit and told Boris Johnson that he would get a very lucrative U.S.-UK trade deal in the aftermath of Brexit. The difference here is that Joe Biden lines up very squarely with the Democrats in Congress in defending anything that they would view as a threat to the Good Friday Agreement. So this new Internal Market Act that the Johnson government is proposing is viewed as something that could erode the Good Friday Agreement. And Biden is taking the traditional Democratic position, which puts him at odds with the British government should Boris Johnson go ahead with this legislation, which, as we know, is not totally clear yet.
There's also this issue that Biden would very much like a Brexit deal to take place. And were things not to turn out in that way, and that there is a no deal, we're not dealing now with a Donald Trump who's happily along the line to easily strike a trade deal with the United Kingdom, or so Boris Johnson would have hoped. But Joe Biden is very much a multilateralism-focused president. He will be pivoting hard to Europe, as also his new Secretary of State will do.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Joe Biden, when he came to Britain a few years ago and voiced his disagreement with Brexit, the way he phrased it was he'd always viewed Britain's value to the U.S. As being a sort of a bridge between the U.S. and Europe. It can't play that role outside of the European Union, so it will change inevitably. But the last thing that Joe Biden wants is a rift between two of the U.S.'s most important allies, the continental European allies of Germany and France on the one hand, and the United Kingdom on the other hand. So for him, beyond the issue of the Good Friday Agreement, there's a broader imperative here, which is to avoid these kinds of rifts. Donald Trump, in a sense, thrived on these rifts and even encouraged them. But for Joe Biden, they'd be a real negative. And so he wants to see this trade agreement worked out, and he wants to see his allies all pulling in the same direction.
What about the personal relationship between the two men? I mean, the fact that Joe Biden has described Boris Johnson as a kind of physical and emotional clone of Donald Trump does not bode well, does it?
Well, the first thing you need to say is there isn't much of a personal relationship. They've not met. They have spoken on the telephone. But, you know, it's interesting for a leader like Joe Biden, who knows literally dozens and dozens of heads of state around the world. He doesn't know Boris Johnson. And there is a slight bit of scar tissue left over from the Obama administration. You'll recall that in 2016, when Barack Obama visited the UK before the Brexit referendum, Boris Johnson, who was then the mayor of London, wrote a piece in the newspaper in which he described Obama as having a part Kenyan ancestral dislike of the British Empire. This is a line that really sat badly with people around Barack Obama and Joe Biden. And some of those people are working for the new Biden administration. So while I don't think this is a major problem, I do think there will be some people around Biden that will view Boris Johnson with some suspicion, and he may need to do a little bit of repair work on that front.
In that respect, can the United Kingdom under Boris Johnson have good relations with the United States? Or given what's happened over the last 4 years on both sides of the Atlantic, is the special relationship now damaged in the long term and will require a lot more care and attention?
I think it's fair to say that the special relationship will be somewhat less special, partly because Joe Biden will have so many other things on his plate and so many other priorities. It's also not clear to me that the Biden administration puts nearly as much emphasis on doing a trade deal with the United Kingdom. Having said that, though, these are still countries with a great deal of shared interest and values. They're both members of NATO. Joe Biden's going to re-emphasize NATO. He's going to count on the UK to help him do that. And, you know, in some of these issues, standing up for democratic values, pushing against the Russians and the Chinese, the UK is still an obvious partner for the United States. So I think the way I would phrase it is not that the relationship is going to go into a downward spiral. I think it may be somewhat less special than it was under the Trump administration. But these are countries that will still find a great deal to do in working with each other.
Mark Landler, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Monocle 24. Then. Just nudging 7:13 here in London, 8:13 if you're listening in Zurich. We'll be hearing from the Swiss President Zamoruga a little later this hour. But first, Argentina has declared 3 days of national mourning following the death of Diego Maradona, heralded as one of the footballer's greatest players in history. He was also infamous for his exploits off the pitch. Well, following years of health problems, Maradona died on Wednesday in Tigray in Argentina. His spokesman said the cause was a heart attack. Monocle's contributing editor Andrew Muller looks back now at his life.
Turns like a little eel and comes away from trouble. Little squat man comes inside Butcher, leaves him for dead. Outside Fennec leaves him for dead and puts the ball away. And that is why Maradona is the greatest player in the world.
Whatever he did look like, it wasn't a footballer. He was short, about 5'5", and stocky. He seemed as wide as he was tall. If you had to guess which field of athletics he would succeed in, it might be weightlifting or wrestling. If you met him, this opinion might well be reinforced. In no realm did he seem at home with airs or graces. Diego Armando Maradona was born on October 30th, 1960 in Lanús, just south of Buenos Aires. His childhood was spent in the shanty town of Villa Fiorito on the Argentine capital's outskirts. He was spotted early. He was 15 when he made his Primera División debut in 1976. He was 16 the first time he wore the blue and white stripes of Argentina in 1977, though he was omitted from the Argentina side which won the World Cup at home in 1978. He became the world's most expensive footballer in 1982, moving to Barcelona after starring in that year's World Cup in Spain. Barcelona knew what they were getting. Despite aggressive, if not brutal, man-marking, Maradona was magnificent. But he had his limits. Against Brazil, Argentina's cause lost, he was sent off for a foul which appeared calculated to cut Brazilian defender Batista in two. Things did not go well at Barcelona. Maradona was ill, injured, and eventually dumped after just two seasons, following his ignition of an almighty brawl in the 1984 Copa del Rey final against Athletic Bilbao.
De Maradona, peligrosísima volada de Maradona. Observen ustedes el intercambio.
For another world record fee, he was transferred to Napoli. He led an ordinary team to extraordinary success. Two Serie A titles, a Coppa Italia and a UEFA Cup, among others. In Naples' municipal mythology, he was regarded as something not far short of godlike. Many are today's Neapolitans born around that time named Diego or Diego. Maradona also became friendly with certain well-known members of the local business community, was banned for 15 months after failing a cocaine test, and slunk away in disgrace. Maradona's Jekyll and his Hyde will always be most famously illustrated by the events of June 22, 1986, at Estadio Azteca in Mexico City. It was a World Cup quarter-final, so the stakes were plenty high enough anyway, but Argentina were playing England. It was 4 years and 8 days since Argentine forces had surrendered to the British Army in the Falklands. Argentina regarded this game as a rematch. Argentina won 2-1 and Maradona scored both goals, very arguably the two most famous goals of all time. The first was also one of the most outrageous acts of chicanery in sporting history. Unable to propel himself high enough to get his forehead on a miscued clearance by England's Steve Hodge, Maradona raised a fist and smacked the ball past oncoming England goalkeeper Peter Shilton.
They're appealing for offside. The ball came back off the foot of Steve Hodge and Maradona gives Argentina the lead. The England players protesting to the referee.
Everybody saw it but the referee. Possibly seeking to rub it in, Maradona later slyly credited the goal to a combination of his own head and the hand of God. 4 minutes later, Maradona received a pass inside Argentina's half, then headed for goal, both bolting and gliding, bewitching and bewildering Peter Beardsley, Peter Reid, Terry Butcher and Terry Fenwick, before slotting the enchanted ball past Shilton.
Oh, you have to say that's magnificent. There is no debate about that goal. That was just pure football genius.
Possibly seeking to rub that in as well, Maradona later thanked the England players for their gallantry. Lesser men, he suggested, would simply have kicked him up in the air. It is difficult to believe that this thought did not occur to them. Argentina won the 1986 World Cup thanks largely to a dominant performance by their diminutive talisman. Maradona verged at this point on the supernatural.
But now it's over, and Argentina are the new world champions. 3-2.
The rest of Maradona's career played out to the same chorus of astonished applause and resigned sighs. In 1990, he very nearly won Argentina another World Cup. In 1994, he was sent home early after failing a drug test. A few more seasons of fading football followed, then a career coaching at clubs of whom few had heard before Maradona turned up to manage them, usually briefly. The low light of a short stint in charge of Argentina's national side was getting clobbered 6-1 in a World Cup qualifier by the generally little feared Bolivia.
Bolivia le ha ganado a la Argentina por 6-1.
Neither Maradona's personal life nor public conduct became synonyms for probity and dignity. He received a suspended jail sentence for shooting four journalists with an air rifle outside his home in Buenos Aires. On a return visit to Naples, he had the two Rolex watches he habitually wore seized by local police as part payment for the 30 million euros he still owed the Italian treasury in taxes. But no stupidity he perpetrated off the field ever quite occluded the memory of the miracles he performed on it. There are those athletes who have the power to change a contest above and beyond their ability, colossal though it may be. Space bends and time slows around them. The very fact of their presence alters things, their charisma, their reputation, that half second of doubt they instill in their opponents. They are of that caliber for whom a game or a race is half won before it even starts. You think of Ayrton Senna, Usain Bolt, Shane Warne, Serena Williams, and you most certainly think of Diego Maradona.
That was just pure football genius. And the crowd in the Azteca Stadium stand him.
For Monocle 24, I'm Andrew Miller.
Away from another, and the coolness under pressure to play the ball home with the side of his foot.
Thank you very much indeed to Andrew Muller there. You're listening to The Globalist live on Monocle 24. The time is just coming up to 7:29 here in London. Still to come, we find out why Qantas is telling people that they're not allowed to board one of their aircraft until they've had a COVID vaccine. Plus, we go through the newspapers and the business news too. But first, a quick summary of the world news headlines. Donald Trump has pardoned his former top security adviser Michael Flynn, who pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI. Flynn was among several former aides to President Trump convicted during an investigation into alleged Russian election interference. The president said the act of clemency was his great honour. A British-Australian academic has thanked her supporters and diplomatic efforts to secure her release from jail in Iran. Kylie Moore Gilbert spent more than 2 years in prison for spying, which she always denied. She was released in exchange for three Iranians who'd been detained abroad. And Germany has asked countries across the EU to keep their ski resorts closed until the start of January to stop the spread of coronavirus. Italy's Prime Minister has already backed a delay to the start of the ski season, but says it has to be Europe-wide. Austria's finance minister has warned against the plan. And those are the headlines on Monocle 24. Now on The Globalist, we head to the home of Monocle's headquarters, Switzerland. This week, we celebrate both the return of our leadership podcast, The Chiefs with Tyler Brulé, and the launch of Monocle's December-January issue. Inside this edition, you find interviews with the people leading Switzerland through a turbulent year with poise and positivity. Well, leading the charge is the Swiss president, Simonetta Sommaruga. She joined us both as the star of the issue and as a guest on this week's episode of The Chiefs. Tyler joined Madame Sommaruga in her office in Bern. They talked about everything from the Swiss approach to the pandemic to how best to do justice to the nation's ambitions on the world stage. They began by talking about whether the pandemic has been a test for Swiss federalism.
In Switzerland, we are really the country of the minorities. Every one of us is in a minority, from the language, the religion, the political party, cultural. Also politically, we have a referendum, we vote four times a year. And I think every one of us is on one Sunday of a referendum, we are in the minority. There's no party which is always in the majority. So even I think this sense for minority helps us to have this sense that it's not enough that I look for me and I'm living in Zurich and so for me it's fine. So I think that helps us also in the crisis. Of course, federalism is also, from my point of view, something which is really a strength of Switzerland because it helps us. You have an idea in one canton, you can do it. You don't have to wait until everybody asks for that. So we have really this laboratory situation. In the pandemic situation, in the beginning, of course, there was the Federal Council who had to take the decisions. And now we are in this situation, we have to learn where is federalism still very positive, because it helps us to take the decisions very close and very specific and very fast. And at the same time, I think in a pandemic where the changes can be so fast and the decisions sometimes have to be taken so fast, that there we see now, we say this is a stress test for federalism. And I think that the last days were very interesting, or the last weeks. It shows that even federalism, which is very strong, but we can be very pragmatic on that. At one moment we say, okay, federalism, this is great, but now the cantons come and ask federal council to take a decision. So it's also part of federalism, that the cantons can ask the central government or the government to take decisions which concerns them. So I think federalism is not only, and this is maybe a little bit another point of federalism, that until now you say federalism means everybody can do as he likes. And now it's also, but federalism means that cantons can also ask government to act for them.
Let's move from the cantons and let's look externally now. And if we cast our eye around the world, for your colleagues, of course, in the Department of Foreign Affairs, and of course, many other departments as well, how difficult has it been to maintain relationships with Madrid, to maintain relations with Ottawa or Canberra in this time?
Well, when you cannot see each other, you cannot travel, of course, I mean, this is part of diplomatic exchange. I can say for my, because in Switzerland, the president, one of the tasks of the president is also to represent our country abroad. So it was almost not possible to go abroad. So how do you do that? I had a telephone diplomacy. I made a lot of phone calls with colleagues I knew for a long time already, but also with colleagues that I have never seen.
Do you prefer an old-fashioned phone call rather than a video call? I'm intrigued because I prefer just a voice. I don't need to see everybody necessarily, because sometimes I feel there's a nuance that you can hear.
Yes, I am a musician, so I can listen. I like to hear the voice. It can be a very intimate situation, just the voice, not to look at. But I had also a video conference, only we two with Chancellor Merkel. We know each other, so we were both at the table, and suddenly we almost forgot a little bit that it was by video, because really the way you have your hands, you laugh. Because I wanted to see her, we had a lunch together, and instead of the lunch, at the same moment, we did this video conference. But usually I think a phone call gives really somehow an intimate atmosphere, which you are very much concentrated on what you're saying and the voice. So I like that. But I was very glad. I had one of my first travel I did to Ukraine. Switzerland is very much engaged in Ukraine. And I will never forget that, because I was calling the president of Ukraine, Zelensky, in March. I wanted to travel. I couldn't at that moment. We had to postpone. But he asked me if Switzerland could help them to have more ventilators. So, well, I said, okay, well, let's see what we can do. And then there was a Swiss high school, ETH. They developed a ventilator to produce cheap but well-functioning. And they had an exchange with Ukraine. And when I went to Ukraine at the end of July, there was a cooperation between ETH and Ukraine, and they presented me the first ventilator produced in Ukraine. For me, this was really wonderful to see how countries can work together also in this situation. At the same time, going to Ukraine was important for me. I mean, we were all corona, everything corona, but we have a country in Europe where there is a war. And I went together with the president of Ukraine to the eastern part of Ukraine. We went in this part where Switzerland is very much engaged. They produce drinking water for more than 4 million people in eastern Ukraine. And we went there together. And I thought that it's important also, corona is so heavy, but at the same time, do not forget that there are other situations. Do not forget people living there. They have, beside corona, the war. And I'm very glad I could do that, because I think we should not forget we have the climate crisis. And for me, it was always important, also with my international contacts, to really concentrate, of course, on corona, but not forget the other.
And our thanks to Madame Simonetta Sommaruga and also to our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé. To read the full interview with President Sommaruga, head to monocle.com to buy our latest edition. And to catch the full episode of The Chiefs, go to monocle.com/radio or wherever you get your podcasts. And Monocle's December-January issue, including our annual soft power survey, is on newsstands right now. You're with The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
Let's continue now with today's newspapers. Joining me is the journalist Ruth Michelson. Hello, Ruth.
Morning, Emma.
Let us begin with the consequences, the fallout from this astonishing journey that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu made from Israel to meet the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia, only for everyone to deny it, or the Saudis at least.
That's right. It's really bizarre. Diplomatic incident, I suppose you would say, happened earlier this week. So, you know, this meeting happens. There's plenty of details in the Israeli press. The Jerusalem Post doesn't just, you know, have details of the meeting. They mentioned that Netanyahu used a private plane belonging to a particular Israeli businessman that he uses for diplomatic trips. They mentioned the time the plane left Israel and the time that it came back. And then we see, you know, in, for example, in the New York Times, in The Guardian, there's a quote from the Saudi foreign minister, Prince Faisal bin Farhan, who said there was no meeting. Saudi and American officials were the only ones present.
That makes very little sense, given what everybody else said.
Absolutely. So, I mean, it's fair to ask what happened. I think, you know, we're seeing some analysis contained in the reporting, again in the New York Times, saying the conflicting statements reflected different priorities. So it's very normal for Israel to want to promote this kind of meeting. It shows that they're getting what they want. But the Saudis have in the past insisted that before any kind of normalization agreement, that there must be an Israeli-Palestinian peace deal first. And so everybody's acting in their own interests, even if it does seem quite bizarre to deny that a meeting happened that quite clearly happened.
Indeed, the British Guardian newspaper says that if there's any agreement to keep the meeting secret, possibly to save Saudi Arabia's leadership from facing anger from its pro-Palestinian population, it was soon broken. Do we know what the relationship is now, or what is being said between Saudi Arabia and the Palestinians?
There hasn't been any mention of that. The moment, you know, there's been a bit of focus on the fact that there is renewed discussion between Israel and the Palestinians, or in the sense that the Palestinian Authority has agreed to continue dealing with Israel after it cut off relations earlier this year. But in terms of Saudi communication with the Palestinians, it's really focused on this rather bizarre meeting, I think, because it's hard to think of another time that something like this has happened.
Let's move on to another story. Egypt is defying its critics, arresting three members of a leading human rights organisation. Tell us more about that, please, Ruth.
So this is in a reaction to the arrests of three members of the Egyptian Initiative for Personal Rights. That came after they met with a group of foreign diplomats for what was a routine meeting. Unfortunately, given that Egypt has quite a history of cracking down on human rights groups, even this is unusual to arrest people just for meeting with foreign diplomats. So you'll see that, you know, this is a story that is getting a lot of play in the international media for that reason. The Washington Post Post looks at how the founder of EIPR, who's also a very prominent investigative journalist, Hossein Begert, has gone to rejoin the what he says are its brave and talented staff in the face of this full-on war that they're facing against the Egyptian government. I have a story in The Guardian that looks at, you know, the fact that these arrests happened in as the American transition or the transition to the Joe Biden presidency is happening. And we see a buildup in lobbying efforts from the Egyptian side in Washington, D.C., so that the incoming Biden administration will pay less attention in their eyes to this kind of human rights abuse.
And when you have experienced this firsthand in Egypt, you had to leave, didn't you? What, when you get lobbying voices and international criticism, what effect does it actually have on the way that the Egyptians run things?
I mean, there is a real sense that outside pressure is something that in the past Egypt has listened to. And I think this case in particular that we're seeing now is presenting this big test. So, you know, we see that Egypt requests roughly $1.38 billion every year in funding from the United States. So they tend to have quite a say, or at least they are given a lot of space to express their opinion internationally because it's considered to carry more weight. But at the same time, there has to be a willing partner on the other end. And what we're seeing from Egypt increasingly is that they're spending more money on lobbyists in DC, but they're not necessarily listening when various international governments raise objections to exactly this kind of thing. I mean, the Egyptian Ministry for Foreign Affairs has basically said that anybody who's been commenting on this case is basically, you know, just trying to interfere, and that they should basically, you know, stop commenting, to leave them alone. And that this group has, you know, been meeting with foreign diplomats to tarnish Egypt's image.
Finally, could you tell us a little bit more about how the Israeli Defense Force is getting ready to possibly carry out a final act by Donald Trump as literally a parting shot?
Yes, so this is the discussion around the idea that there might be more Trump chaos to come before he leaves office in January. There's still time to go, unfortunately. So this is a scoop from Axios, looking at how the Israeli Defense Force has been instructed to prepare in case Trump decides to attack Iran before he leaves office. This comes off the back of a New York Times report, which mentions Trump rather casually discussing whether to bomb a nuclear facility in Iran during a meeting of top officials. And it's also worth mentioning, this isn't just about Trump, it's also about the people around him who enable this kind of behavior, because Mike Pompeo, in his visit to the region earlier this week, also discussed potential attacks on Iran. And State Department officials who traveled with him told reporters that all options are on the table.
Ruth Michelson, thank you as ever for joining us on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Globalist. It's time to talk business with Tai Genwright, Monocle 24 regular business analyst. Welcome back, Tai. Good morning.
Emma, good morning to you.
Right, let's begin with the AstraZeneca vaccine, which everybody thought was wonderful until we all realised that the efficacy of the vaccine was only determined when someone started to make some pretty serious mistakes.
Yeah, that's right. We were very excited by this when it came out earlier this week. Details of the efficacy of this AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine developed here in the UK. It was, of course, the third big vaccine announcement in recent weeks. Although, as you say, we were a little bit disappointed by the headline efficacy rate, which was listed at 70%, much smaller than the others at 95%, those by Pfizer and Moderna. But we took some comfort in some data within the data, which the researchers pointed out to us, saying that it could be up to 90% effective, depending on the dose, because they said there was some evidence that if you halved the initial dose, the first of two doses you have to take, you had better results. But it's now transpiring that that evidence didn't come out of some kind of planned process of kind of varying levels of research or different kind of research strategies. It was a mistake, basically, that some recipients had not received the full dose up front, and that we'd only really gotten to this, you know, somewhat more optimistic state through an accident. And that has obviously undermined some confidence in this vaccine among researchers, particularly in the United States. And it could mean that the Oxford vaccine might not get fast track approval for use there. Now, I'm sure there'll be many people jumping up and down and saying that this is a classic case of kind of British versus American, you know, competing vaccine teams or competing forces, competing with each other and trying to undermine the other one's team, because, of course, these other two vaccines have come out of the United States. But clearly it's not something we want at this stage in the coronavirus pandemic, that one of our great saviours has its confidence in it undermined.
It does. And what it does is it opens up the bigger question as well, which I think has been debated quite a lot, is because it is cheaper and it is not as difficult to keep, to store as the Pfizer or the Moderna versions, will people naturally go to AstraZeneca for economic rather than safety reasons?
Yes, although you can look at it in another way as well. I mean, the cheapness and the relative ease with which you can store the Oxford jab is seen as an advantage, particularly in less well-off countries who can afford potentially more doses and will have to invest less in distribution infrastructure, for example, to keep the substance, the material, the magic material, very cold, as you have to do in the case of I can't remember which one of these other vaccines, but one of them has to be kept very cold. But I think, you know, fundamentally, what we want to know is that this vaccine is safe and that it works. And considering the rush job which has been put on all of these, considering that normally it takes many years, up to 10 years to develop a vaccine, and these have been developed in just 10 months, what you don't want in an era of anti-vaccine disinformation is to have anything which might undermine confidence in that fast-track process.
Let us move on to a quite astonishing story that it's now emerged that Eurostar wants a sort of regular shuttle under the channel going between London, Paris, London, Brussels, London, really connecting to the continent, runs one train a day now to Paris from London.
One to Paris and another to Brussels and Amsterdam. But yes, it does contrast starkly with where it was before the pandemic, with 50 services a day, 50 running between these great European cities. And, you know, there's been so much talk of the airlines which have been suffering during this pandemic with a sharp, you know, the dramatic downturn in international travel. Perhaps there's been less focus on what's happened to international train services, because, of course, they're subject to the same issues about quarantine on arrival. And Eurostar, which operates the train between London, Paris, Brussels and Amsterdam, says it's fighting for survival and it's asking for help from the British government, pointing out that in recent days the government has announced a support scheme for UK airports rather than airlines, but they're giving airports an £8 billion tax holiday. And Eurostar is saying, well, you know, we compete with airports as well as airlines, and if you're going to offer them help to survive, well, we would quite like some too.
What is the likelihood of the help coming?
I think it's slim. You know, it would set a yet another precedent. And much of this airport package has really been targeted at regional airports who are really facing a battle for survival. Some of them have lost entire airlines serving them. We're not talking about the big boys in town in the UK context, Heathrow and Manchester Airports Group. So, you know, perhaps the right word and the right ear might yield some kind of help or support. But if you consider that the UK has been hesitant to bail out its airlines, and indeed Eurostar is effectively under French ownership, you could argue that they're asking the wrong government.
Some enormous news in publishing as well. Bertelsmann, the German media group, has bought Simon & Schuster.
Well, they've indicated they signaled a deal to buy Simon & Schuster. Whether or not it actually gets the green flag from regulators is another thing. But yes, Bertelsmann is the biggest publisher in the world. It owns Penguin Random House, which I think is its best known brand name in terms in publishing, and it's buying or announced a deal to buy a much smaller US rival, although the third biggest publisher in the United States, Simon & Schuster. Now, just to put into context how these two companies stack up, Penguin Random House has annual revenues of $4.3 billion as of last year. Simon Schuster had revenues of $200 million. So that just gives you a sense as to just how big Penguin Random House already is. And now, if this deal goes through, it's going to get a bit bigger. Now, it did get into a bidding war with other rivals, such as News Corp, which owns HarperCollins. HarperCollins is the second biggest publisher in the US, and they're pretty unhappy that Penguin Random House has won, because if actually this deal goes through, Bertelsmann would have a third of the US book market. That would make it three times bigger than HarperCollins. And while competition regulators haven't said anything about it yet, I think there's no doubt that they will be looking at it, because it's not just rival publishers this will bother, but also people who actually write these books. We heard from one independent literary agent who spoke to the New York Times, pointing out that having such a giant in the game really gives them greater power when it comes to dealing with authors and perhaps squeezing better deals out of them.
Tyg Enright, as ever, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Globalist. Finally, the world is once again looking ahead to a day when not even a second thought is given to jumping on a plane and crossing the world. That time, we are being told, is dependent on a vaccine for COVID-19. And the aviation industry is quick to seize upon this, not least because it has been badly hit by the pandemic. Well, Qantas have made the decision to only allow passengers on board who have been given a COVID-19 vaccine. Peter Morris is a chief economist for Cirium, a global travel and data analysis giant. Welcome, Peter.
Welcome.
This seems quite a dramatic plan.
Well, the airlines are really looking for how do we get out of this? And what we've seen is not exactly even false dawns. I mean, there have been opportunities for people to boost their schedules and so on, but either the passengers have been prevented by their own decisions or by governments from travelling. So it's just not viable unless this particular issue can be addressed.
So we are looking at just Qantas leading the way here, or will we be looking at a day when no vaccine, no flying?
Well, I think the practicalities of it have got to work out in terms of just how many people are getting vaccines by what date. Airlines can't really afford to be saying we're not going to do anything till 2024 when everybody's vaccinated. But there is a problem, particularly within the industry on long-haul meeting, short-haul, is that people are mixing together from all kinds of different origins and destinations. So you've got to have some kind of standardized rule, although it has to be said that actually on board the aircraft is one of the safest environments in terms of communicating this particular virus.
Are we now looking that this will be the only way that we can really kickstart the aviation industry again?
Well, I think it's worth looking back to the time of SARS, because that's really an indicator. Yes, it's got different dimensions of the virus, but nonetheless, the same kind of issue of people who would pass on the virus to other people. But there it was much more detectable. Here the problem is you just haven't got that level of detection that you had with SARS that meant you could track and trace it much more effectively. So the virus, the vaccine, to some extent, is the only way out past that.
Some have suggested that this is a really difficult question in terms of personal freedom, that in order to regain the freedom of travel, you have to give up the freedom of the choice as to whether you take a vaccine or not. I mean, how much do the aviation industry have to factor this in?
Well, ultimately, the whole thing depends on whether people choose to make trips. So the airlines can only put a portfolio of services in front of people with the conditions attached and then see who travels. And if, for example, the effect you're mentioning is a significant effect, then they're going to have to row back from that, because you can't fly a commercial air service if you don't get the people paying the money and wanting to be on board.
And you also have the issue of, nation states saying, actually, we're not going to force people to take the vaccine. I think it was, and then the last couple of days, Emmanuel Macron, the French president, has said that vaccination will not be mandatory. Is Qantas going to have to say, well, we're going to have to factor out possibly the French part of the business because they're not going for the vaccine? It suddenly starts to pit business, science and countries all against each other uncomfortably, doesn't it?
Well, ultimately, if the airlines take a decision that turns out to be non-commercial, they're the ones that are going to be hurt. So it's not a question of we will resolutely enforce this no matter what, because if the consequences of that, you go out of business, you're going to have to think about it again. Maybe it's a kind of negotiating point to see, well, at the moment, that looks like the only line we can take. But in the practicalities of the commercial business, and let's say a lot of their competitors don't do it and get the traffic that they miss out on, and you don't get any big further outbreaks, then, of course, you'll start to see Qantas missing out. So you really can't do it on your own in this business. You're going to have to do it across a wide spectrum of carriers. And it may well be that a significant number of carriers feel the way you were expressing, or you find that government put pressure on them.
Peter Morris, thank you so much for joining us on Monocle 24. Well, that's all we have time for today's programme. Thank you to our producers, Daniel Bache, Carlos Robello and Paige Reynolds, our researcher, Charlie Phil-McCourt, and our studio manager, Steph Chungu. After the headlines, more music on the way, and The Briefing is live at midday in London. The Globalist is back at the same time tomorrow, but for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.